small stage.
I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong.
It's not really about going to another solar system. It's about how do we improve life here on Earth.
Not only the question, but the way you try to solve it.
Beauty at this dimension, 1 centimeter, is also beauty at a smaller dimension.
Hello and welcome to Sharing Science Radio. We're broadcasting from CITR 101.9 FM on unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. We cook you up science that goes down smooth. Here you'll hear about how science is done, who's doing it, what it's telling us, and why it matters to you. I'm your host, Alan Manning, and with me today is Rohit Singla and Nathan Evitz. Our show tonight is all about robot ethics. Robots and computers are making more decisions that affect our daily lives. From healthcare to war, split-second choices made by a computer program may have serious implications. So how do we design machines to recognize the consequences of their actions? And who do we hold responsible when something goes wrong? And finally, was setting fire to your Furby when you were 12 years old a barbaric act of torture? Well, we'll try to address some of these questions at least. Rohit's going to talk about some of the ethical issues with robots and how humans view their mechanical creations. Nathan then leads us down an intricate robotic path of love, money, and war. Already sounds pretty human to me. And after that, Rohit and I will geek out and dive deeper into these questions. Now, if tonight, at some point, the broadcast cuts out, the computers in the recording booth have become self-aware and have started murdering us. So let's get started before that happens. Rohit?
So imagine a world, much like ours in the own near future, where robots are seamlessly integrated into our society. They've become ubiquitous. Some are autonomous, others are semi-autonomous. They assist in our healthcare, they assist in our wars, and they assist really in our daily lives. It actually sounds like our future is here today. So that raises a really good question, actually. When these robots are faced with really an uncountable number of scenarios, and the fact that we've spent centuries pondering our own humanity, our own ethics, our own philosophies, what do we do about the robots? Who decides what is ethical for robots? How do we agree on that? Given a situation where a robot faces a complex ethical decision, much like ones we may face on our day-to-day lives, where do we even begin? Well, a group of researchers from the University of British Columbia try to put some answers to those questions. A. Jung Moon and members of the CARES Lab at UBC surveyed 300 participants, providing them with 9 real quotes or situations and a question about those. For example, should robots replace humans in tasks for physical care of the elderly? Things you and I could do, but a robot could just do as well. Should robots be taking on humanoid form? Participants answered yes, no, or neutral, and justified their answers. The 300 participants were split into 3 cohorts, with 3 classes in each. That is, 1 group of experts, 1 group of layperson, and a mix. And the answers were interesting, to say the least. As an example, when asked if remote-controlled predator drones should be armed, people were actually polarized, much to my surprise, at least. What about safety, they asked? What about the benefits? Is this reliable? Is killing even justified? Moon et al. Found that all the described robots received some support due to their functional efficiency and some rejection due to doubts on their reliability. Rejection was most prominent in military robotics, actually, particularly in fully autonomous predator drones, than it was in, say, healthcare or elderly care. In short, they found that the robot's autonomy, not the perceived efficiency, whether they could do their job really well or not, affected how participants responded. But you gotta ask, is something like this enough? Or is this just the starting point to, really, another century's worth of discussion on philosophy and ethics?
Thanks for that, Rohit. Now, Nathan, what's your story all about?
To start out, I'm going to go back in time and start with Alan Turing. Some of you may know about Turing from a recent movie, The Imitation Game. Turing was a mathematician, and the movie described his efforts to break the World War II German encryption technique Enigma. To accomplish this, Turing builds a machine, plausibly one of the world's first computers. Anyways, Turing is widely viewed as a father of artificial intelligence and computer science, so much so that, to this day, a litmus test for artificial intelligence bears his name. It's called the Turing test, and it goes like this. An observer reads text from a conversation between an artificial intelligence program and a human, without being told which is which. If the observer can't tell the difference between the human and the computer, the program passes the test. Now, since the invention of this test by Turing in 1950, practical considerations have meant that the test is not all that meaningful if you're trying to measure how intelligent a computer program is. The reason is that artificial intelligence programs and humans who write them cheat. The first and easiest way to cheat is to offer some human explanation for the weird, bizarre things that a typical program might do. In the past, doctors, for instance, have been fooled into thinking that they were conversing via computer with schizophrenic patients. But the most widespread, readily digested explanation for these non-human traits is to pretend to be a foreigner, someone with cultural differences who maybe doesn't speak English all that well. And nowhere is this more prevalent than the world of online dating. As an example, in 2007, an American psychologist named Robert Epstein entered the online dating world where he discovered a young Russian beauty named Ivana, who seemed very affectionate, even if her English was a little off. Here's a quote from an email that Dr. Epstein received from the woman. I'm going to read it in a feminine Russian accent to add to the hilarity. I may not do a Russian accent very well. I have told to mine close friends about you and to my parents and tell them happy that I really interested someone and regardless of the fact that not here in Russia and all from them happy for me that I have met you. I have very special feelings about you. It, in the same way as the beautiful flower blossoming in mine soul, I only cannot explain, but I confident that you will understand me, so I wish to know that makes you think, and I shall wait your answer, holding my fingers have crossed. After about 4 months of conversation, mostly about Ivana's family and friends, but suspiciously void of other topics like movies, books, politics, etc., Epstein began to wonder about this newfound internet girl. So he probed her with a provocative question about Vladimir Putin, and still received answers regarding family and friends. Finally, Epstein concocted a definitive test designed to determine whether Ivana was a beautiful young Russian woman in love with him, or if she was a robot. Epstein sent her an email that reads as follows. ADSF semicolon JK, AS semicolon JK, L semicolon JK, J semicolon J, with love / Robert. To which Ivana responded with a long letter about her mother. The story of how Dr. Epstein was fooled by an online robot is a little ironic, since Epstein has a PhD in psychology from Harvard and is himself somewhat an authority in the field. Epstein, for example, directed an early 1990 event called the Annual Loebner Prize Competition in Artificial Intelligence. It's a competition in which judges attempt to distinguish between people and computer programs. The robot that tricked Epstein cheated at the Turing test. But it wasn't just the poor English and the Russian cultural background that fooled him. In a 2007 article in the magazine Scientific American Mind, Epstein admits, "I had wanted to believe that a beautiful young woman really cared about me." The example of a computer program masquerading as a beautiful Russian woman online strikes a familiar chord with it. It represents a new incarnation of an old confidence scam. The fact that the scam is automated is new, but hardly frightening. However, in other scenarios, the vast power of an automated artificial intelligence can do real damage. The stock market on May 6, 2010 serves as a perfect example. On that day, computer programs cost the world about $1 trillion. To explain how this could happen, I'll back up a bit and talk a little about how algorithms and computers are used in today's market. An example of a trading algorithm is one called arbitrage. Here's how it works. Say, for example, someone offers an IBM share for sale on the New York Stock Exchange for 99 cents. At the same time, someone else is offering to buy a different IBM share on the Chicago Exchange for a dollar. The algorithm called arbitrage buys the 99 cents share in New York and quickly sells it in Chicago for a dollar. By doing this, it turns a profit of one penny, which doesn't sound like much. But by automating this process with a computer and performing these trades millions of times a day, a large profit can be made for, say, a trading firm. The key to winning the game is to be fast, and firms use supercomputers wired with fiber optic cable to do this. And that allows trades to be completed in billionths of a second. Combined with this speed is an entire army of math geniuses, physicists, computer scientists, and economists designing artificial intelligence programs which recognize patterns in the stock market. The programs are able to synthesize huge amounts of information, the recent history of stock market trades, a list of backlog trades that are about to be made, for instance, and then place new trades which exploit that information to make money. Now, aside from the fact that this might seem unfair to everyday investors who cannot afford to buy supercomputers, there's another reason to worry about computers placing billions of trades per second without any human supervision. On May 6th, 2010, major stock exchanges, including the Dow and the S&P, rapidly fell about 6%, representing a worldwide loss of about $1 trillion. This event came to be known as the Flash Crash of 2010. On that day, a whole bunch of artificial intelligence programs did something that no human expected. They sold stocks so fast that many of the prices tanked before any human could react. The event terrified investors because it was so big and so fast, and because it happened over the course of about 30 minutes and for no apparent reason. The lack of human control during this situation scared many, and activities like this led to a 2013 study published in the journal Scientific Communications. The study analyzed stock prices on the very short time scales that computers would use to make trades. Basically, the researchers went through stock market data from 2006 to 2011 with a giant magnifying glass looking for anomalies. They looked for changes in price that happened much faster than any human could trade stocks. The effort uncovered upwards of 18,000 so-called ultra-fast extreme events. What is an ultra-fast extreme event? It's basically a crash or a spike in the market that lasts only 1.5 seconds or less. Luckily for us, none of these were as big as the flash crash of 2010. Okay, so we've talked about artificial intelligence applications in internet scams like online dating and in the stock market. And finally, we come to potentially the scariest application for artificial intelligence, autonomous weapons. On July 18th, 2015, the Future of Life Institute released an open letter expressing alarm over the rising threat of autonomous weapons. Now, lest you think that the Future of Life Institute is some conspiracy theory hub for sci-fi enthusiasts, the list of 25,000 signatures on their open letter includes names like Elon Musk, Bill Gates, and Stephen Hawking. The Institute, co-founded by an MIT physics professor, Max Tegmark, has noted that, quote, autonomous weapons are ideal for tasks such as assassination, destabilizing nations, subduing populations, and selectively killing a particular ethnic group, end quote. That last one is genocide, I believe. Anyway, they also note that if any major military power pushes ahead with artificial intelligence weapon development, a global arms race is virtually inevitable, and the endpoint of this technological trajectory is obvious. Autonomous weapons will become the Kalashnikovs of tomorrow. The Future of Life Institute isn't all doom and gloom. Their stated purpose is to raise these issues now, before artificial intelligence becomes a reality, in order to help our society better navigate these problems when they inevitably arise. They note that it remains unknown whether over the coming decades artificial intelligence will be more like the internet, having a vast upside with relatively small risks, or more like nuclear technologies, with enormous risk relative to the benefit. As part of their effort to address this issue, the Institute recently announced a list of dozens of grants awarded to fund research with focuses on keeping artificial intelligence beneficial. A project from Duke University entitled How to Build Ethics into a Robust Artificial Intelligence strikes one as reminiscent of Isaac Asimov's classic sci-fi novel, I, Robot. Asimov's novel describes a future world populated with as many artificially intelligent robots as humans. In that world, the robots are programmed to obey three rules. Number one, a robot may not injure a human being or, through an action, allow a human being to come to harm. Number two, a robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. Number three, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second laws. Future of Life co-founder Dr. Tegmark is quick to point out the irony of the novels, saying, "The funny thing about Asimov's novels is almost all of the three robotic laws stories are about how something goes wrong with them."
Thanks for that, Nathan. It's interesting that a lot of the issues associated with robot ethics only come up when things do go wrong. Now, we'll be exploring more of this after the break. Stick around for some more Sharing Science on CITR.
Every night, over 700 youth sleep on Vancouver's streets. This is their story. Death in a Dumpster, the musical, is a true story about homelessness, written, composed, and performed by a cast of street-involved youth actors. Death in a Dumpster opens November 7th at Waterfront Theatre for three performances only. For tickets and information, go to www.deathinadumpster.ca. Death in a Dumpster is presented by Access to Music in association with Directions Youth Services.
Welcome back to Sharing Science Radio on CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to our episode that's all about robot ethics. I'm your host, Al Manning, and with me is Rohit Singla.
Howdy doody.
Now, before the break, we heard some interesting stories from you, Rohit, mm-hmm. as well as Nathan, who brought up some of the specific areas where robot ethics could play a role.
Yeah, now that Nathan is gone, I can speak freely.
Yeah, well, actually, one thing I wanted to cover, first of all, is that, you know, we mentioned quite a few buzzwords. Now, we try to keep buzzwords down on Sharing Science Radio.
Yeah, okay.
Try to make it accessible for everyone. And we threw out a lot of words like, you know, robot, automation, computer, artificial intelligence. So, Rohit, what's the difference between all of these? Does robot ethics also apply to artificial intelligence, for example?
Mm.
Is there a difference between AI and computers and robots?
When we talk about artificial intelligence, we're really talking about a system here. And that could be a physical system, such as a robot, or even software that also interacts with the environment. The definition I learned is that artificial intelligence is a system that can act rationally.
So an artificial intelligence is not necessarily something that's self-aware.
No, not necessarily.
Okay.
We'll see artificial intelligence systems, really what are called intelligent agents, agents that can interact with their world.
Something that processes your credit card information, would that be considered as an agent?
That's an agent. You're an agent. Something that's black box.
I'm an agent?
Really, just imagine a black box. Something goes in, something comes out.
So artificial intelligence is just basically something that makes rational decisions.
Yeah. Yeah, we could say that. But when we talk about robot ethics, we were talking about how these systems, how these intelligent agents play a role in certain situations where they face ethical dilemmas.
Is it always situations where humans are involved?
Instinctively, I would have said not necessarily, but really we have to consider the myth of full autonomy here. Something that people don't often recognize is that humans are involved in every step of the way, whether we're interacting with them being robots, or if we're designing them. No human goes out there and says, I'm going to design a robot and, you know, let it design itself and hope it comes up with something else.
And set it free.
And set it free, right? This isn't the movie AI. Humans design robots. Humans are involved in the loop of a robot's life from start to finish.
So basically, we always design robots to interact with humans in some way.
And even if we don't design with that intention, we're the ones creating these robots.
So if we create robots and they go off and they fight their wars and it's terrible and brutal and there's torture involved,
you can't say that humans weren't part of that. We're the ones that designed that.
The myth of full autonomy that you mentioned, that's actually a book by author David Mindel, and he dives into this in some detail. Okay, so let's dive into some of these questions in more detail. Now, what about the issue of robots that look like humans?
See, that's interesting from a psychological point of view. What if you can create a robot that is humanoid and people, as we have been known to do, start feeling affectionate for it or start feeling attracted to it? Studies have shown previously that anything that really looks like an animal or whatnot, we can anthropomorphize. So we essentially give it human traits or make it...
We pretend as though the thing has feelings and motivations.
Much like another human.
Exactly.
Exactly. It's humane. And you run the risk of doing that with robots, believe it or not. And then you get this interesting situation where, can I develop a robot that you, Alan, love? And then can I exploit you through that? Are you going to...
You probably could.
Maybe, hopefully. We'll see. You know, get your wallet. Or can you really design a robot that a child can love and replace a mother, right? And that satisfies that child's needs or takes care of that child and makes it feel more comfortable, right?
And is that okay?
And is that okay?
That's actually a very interesting ethical question. Although I think we do have quite a ways to go before we do develop robots that are truly act like people.
Oh, for sure. The field of artificial intelligence and computers, it's like maybe 60 to 70 years old.
Not only that, but also just the physical appearance and how they move. There's something called the uncanny valley.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it's the idea that people will be okay with robots if they look very different than humans. You know, even if
very different, eh?
Even if they have a humanoid shape, you know, as long as there's wires showing or whatever, that's fine. And they'll be okay with robots that look exactly like humans and move exactly like humans and have facial expressions exactly like humans. Where people tend not to be okay is where you have a robot that is very, very close to being human, but there's just something not quite right about them. You know, maybe they don't blink enough, or maybe they blink too frequently, or their facial expression's kind of weird, or they're not breathing.
And that creeps them out,
That creeps them out. It's kind of like the zombie effect.
Oh, you know,
it's like the,
I haven't heard about
something
this.
That's alive but kind of dead. An interesting area where this also appears is in CGI movies, or computer yeah. animated movies.
Yeah.
And famously in the Polar Express movie, the conductor that was played by Tom Hanks, although they CGI'd him, was thought to be quite creepy because they, you know, his facial expressions weren't quite right and he was just a little bit off.
Oh, I haven't heard this before. This is interesting. I wonder why that is. Because, you know, if you stick to, say, just reading science fiction or watching movies, directors and authors will convey completely different things, right?
Oh, definitely.
Look at, what's it called? Ex Machina, where the guy literally falls in love with this AI robot. I won't spoil it for you, but she goes crazy.
Does she go crazy or does she just go robot?
That's fair. Or is she human? You know, or is he really thinking like a human and acting like a human? But this guy falls in love with this robot, and I never would have thought of something like the Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, obviously, it's a technological hurdle to overcome that, but hopefully that the ethical dilemma about robots that look exactly like humans will be something we won't have to face for too much longer. Now, it's interesting you brought up science fiction. I am personally a huge science fiction fan, and I really like science fiction because it's often in the future, so you have these almost ridiculous situations where you have people and there's some new technology, maybe it's sentient robots or whatever, and then you just kind of press go and you see what happens, and you know, the book evolves along a plot that's hopefully somewhat believable. You know, the better the book, the more believable the plot is, and you see where it goes. And a lot of these issues, these ethical issues, have been explored in science fiction novels before. Also in movies, you mentioned Ex Machina or Ex Machina. So it's quite interesting to see that these ethical dilemmas have been played out for a long time. I mean, even Frankenstein, you know, Frankenstein's monster, the original artificial intelligence. There's so many ethical considerations.
That's true. That's not bad. Okay.
That's actually a great book to read if you want to dive into these issues a little bit more, because it really looks at it from both Dr. Frankenstein, the creator's view, and the monster's view.
So, yes, I agree that, you know, science fiction has explored this realm and people have thought about this and whatnot. But two things I would say is that, A, we haven't been thinking about this nearly long enough. And B, from a scientific point of view, I think there's a huge bias there in regardless of what you do. I think it's weird we're talking about robot ethics because we're really talking about an intersection of science and philosophy and other, you know, non-scientific things. But that's why I really liked A. Jung Moon's research and her survey of 300 participants, because what she found was every situation had some level of rejection in terms of how the robot was being used and justifications for why, as well as some acceptance. You know, they saw efficiency. They saw, yeah, you know, I see some value in this. This is beneficial. What was most interesting to me about her work was that it wasn't really an issue about efficiency or does this robot do its job well. It was how autonomous this thing, right? People seem to be paranoid almost to an extent.
Do you think this is something that is just based on what we've heard about in science fiction stories or movies?
Ooh.
Or do you think this is actually like an inbuilt human fear, you know, fear of the other sort of thing?
Yeah, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy or is it something innate?
I've always kind of actually wondered this. This is going off on a tangent, but I've always wondered this about insects. You know, is the fear of insects, is that built into us, or is that something that we learn to fear over time?
Yeah, a social construct that we've, like, you know, we just don't see often, so it must be creepy and new. I think it's a good mix of both. You know, I'm not going to give you one or the other. I think it's a solid mix of both. I say that because anything new and foreign to us at any given time is always going to be scary. But then there's also this. We have an imagination of where things can go, right? There are scientific advancements we never would have thought of, and there are scientific advancements we're terrified of. Personally, I'm terrified of Tesla's new release. you know, they just updated our cars to have some level of autopilot just with a software download.
But it's still in the beta. I mean, it's, yeah. You know, they've kind of released it with this warning saying, okay, let the Tesla drive itself, but don't take your hands off the wheel.
Yeah, for sure, right? I don't trust people on the road when they're paying attention. Now you're asking me to, like, let them not?
But I guess that's the contradiction, right? Because, like, 90% of accidents, this is a number I grabbed off the internet, but yeah. It's probably close. 90% of the accidents are caused by human error. And people eat and read when they're driving now anyways. Yeah. I mean, look at all the idiots who text and drive.
Yeah, do not text and drive. If you're listening at home, don't be an idiot.
Yeah, so, I guess maybe, even though it's a little bit terrifying to us to give up this control, people are saying that automating your cars is going to reduce the accident rate tremendously. There's actually a good example of ethical problems that can arise with that. So there's a famous philosophical ethics problem called the trolley problem. Basically, the idea is that there's a runaway train. You see a runaway train coming at a group of, let's say, picnickers who are picnicking on the track. It's a family of five. You are just a bystander, but you are sitting right by a switch that can throw this train onto another track that will kill one person. So the ethical dilemma is, do you throw that switch? The problem it's an ethical dilemma is because there's a difference between letting someone die and killing somebody.
Yeah.
And you can mix it up a little bit more, you know? Okay, what about if the family of five is now, five convicted murderers and the other person is a young baby?
Yeah, you know? As you add more information, what changes, right?
Right, and you can see where this is going to come up a lot with self-driving cars. You know,
I can see it with pretty much any robot we have or any system, really.
Well, totally. Just to give you sort of a concrete example, the cars, let's say you're driving down the road and there's a car coming towards you, and let's say you're driving five people in your car, and the only way to escape it is to swerve and take out the motorcyclist beside you. Mm-hmm. So what does the car do? Does it let you and five people die, or does it swerve and kill the motorcyclist beside you?
Right.
How do we decide what the car is going to do in that case? I mean, at some point in the code, you have to say, if this, then this, you know? And you have this scenario where, what does your car decide to do? Does it count how many people are in your car and then says, I'm going to kill the least number of people? Or does your car always say, I'm going to protect whoever's in my car, no matter what.
Yeah.
You know, how do you decide what to do? Yeah, it's interesting because I think often we as scientists get caught up in this mindset that science is the only thing that can guide decisions, when in fact it's only one way of guiding decisions. Often it's the best way, but in things like this, you need to think about ethics as well. This often comes up in medicine as well, too. So it's interesting to look at this sort of collision between philosophy and science. All right, well, I think we better wrap it up there. You've been listening to Sharing Science Radio on CITR. Thank you, Rohit, for joining me.
Thank you, Alan.
I'm Alan Manning. Earlier today, we heard from Nathan Evitz. Please, if you liked what you heard in our episode, or have any comments or want to suggest a future episode, you can write to us at radio@ubcsharingscience.org. That's radio@ubcsharingscience.org. We would love to hear from you. Stay tuned. Up next is Innerspace. See y'all next week.